Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. Mothers and daughters and their sometimes trying relationships. National Book Award nominee Bonnie Jo Campbell will be here to read from her evocative new collection of short stories. Then a story of friendship and change over two decades. Marty Jo Link will tell us about her moving memoir, Drummond Girls. At the end, Fleeta Brown will be here with an audio essay on poet Ed Ochester. I would like to welcome Bonnie Jo Campbell to Michigan Writers on the Air. Bonnie Jo, great having you in the studio again.
Oh, it is a joy to be here.
Before we start talking about your new book of short stories, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about your journey as a writer. You grew up on a farm near Kalamazoo, and you had an early interest in writing.
Yep, I had an interest in writing that almost, for a little while, was bigger than my interest in boys. But, the two are pretty powerful forces in a girl's life. And I did write as a kid, but later on, when I was in college, I kind of fell away from the pursuit of writing because it felt that there were rules I didn't understand. And it seemed as though the world of writing was going to be very competitive, and it scared me a little bit. And I guess I didn't know if I was really cut out for it. I didn't have a lot of confidence that I was good enough. And so I tried not to write, basically.
Then
I failed at not writing.
You started out as a philosophy major at the University of Chicago.
Yep. I really wanted to major in journalism, but they didn't have a journalism program. That was too practical for the institution. And so I really fell in love with philosophy and just loved learning different ways of thinking and learning to study thinking and to really question the way we thought. And I think it's actually been kind of helpful for my writing.
And then from there, you moved to mathematics.
Yeah. Well, at the University of Chicago, the most fascinating people to me were the mathematicians. And they were, oddly enough, also the most social. They had a math tea every Friday, and I was so honored that I would be invited to the math tea. And so after I graduated, I took a little bit of mathematics while I was there and loved it. And then after I graduated and took a little time off, I decided that I wanted to become a mathematician like those people I admired so much.
So you started pursuing a PhD at Western, and you were going to be a math professor someday.
Yes. I studied math education first, and then I decided I wanted the pure thing. So I joined a PhD program, and I really loved it, but I found that it wasn't really satisfying my soul. And it was my mathematics PhD advisor who suggested, after I had gotten my master's along the way, he suggested I go take a creative writing class with Stu Dybeck. And he wasn't available, so I took one with Jamie Gordon, who has since won the National Book Award. And she really encouraged me to make another go at writing, and she encouraged me to join the MFA program, and I did so with some hesitation and trepidation, but once I was in it and once I started to actually learn how to write instead of just going it alone, then I never really looked back.
But apparently math is still part of it, because I've found an article about you where you say writing a short story and working a mathematical proof are very similar.
Yeah, I know I'm going out on a limb there by saying that, but I see the similarities. Much of what you do in higher mathematics is prove things. Often you don't use numbers at all, but you are trying to show a certain kind of truth by proving a theorem. And you are also, in a short story, showing a kind of truth. Now, often these are very different truths, and the language we use to show them is very different. In mathematics, we're absolutely proving them beyond a shadow of a doubt using precise mathematical language, while in a story, we're using something more emotional, something more mysterious to arrive at the truth, but it still has to be just as plausible to the reader of the story as that mathematical language is to the mathematician who's looking for the proof of the theorem.
In the last few months, you've been on a continuous book tour.
Well, I'm just getting started, yep, right now, but I am very much involved in running from town to town.
And you haven't been traveling alone. You've been accompanied by
Flannery
O'Connor.
I feel it's very important to keep always in mind of our literary forebearers. And so for my book release party in Kalamazoo, I had a local printer at Portage Printing create for me a life-size cardboard cutout of a photograph of Flannery O'Connor. And so she travels with me everywhere and inspires me.
In fact, she is standing with us today in the studio.
She is. I wish you all could see her. I think you'll feel her while we're talking. I think you'll feel her looming presence.
Have Flannery O'Connor and other Southern writers been an important part of your thinking about how to create fiction?
Yes, they really have. And Michigan is a mysterious state in a lot of ways. And I think we've got a lot of Southern influence in our state because of a lot of people moving north to work in the auto plants.
Yes.
And so I think... I hung out with girls from Kentucky and Tennessee when I was a kid. Those are the ones that I chased boys with, you know, and got in all kinds of trouble with. And I think I was, maybe there's some influence either personally or maybe it's just in the air. But I feel that the Southern writers embrace their warts and pimples, and they love their weird eccentric aunts who sit on the porch in a rocking chair and drink whiskey or curse.
Smoke a pipe.
Yeah. And I think that I grew up kind of appreciating that sort of personality. And sometimes it's called the Southern grotesque writing. And Flannery O'Connor kind of chafed against that term. She felt that anything that was realistic was written off as grotesque. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's still a little bit of an issue, whether, you know, I do consider myself very much a realist writer. And often that means I'm writing about the bumpy spots in the road, and I'm really showing the rough texture of the pavement. And sometimes people feel a little hurt that I might write about Michigan in a rough way that doesn't show Michigan for all its glories. And we have those as well. We have glorious things, but we have some troubles in our economy and in our communities. And what fiction writers like to write about is trouble.
Exactly. So Flannery O'Connor also was referred to as part of the Southern Gothic school.
Yeah, and I've been invited to speak about Flannery O'Connor at the Library of Congress next March.
Oh, that's
and so
exciting.
I'm pretty nervous. And so she's my bedtime reading every night. And that's interesting to think about it being Southern Gothic, because we think all the other Gothic kinds of writing are things like ghost stories. Mm-hmm. I'm still not sure what I'm going to say about Flannery in March, but I'm feeling closer and closer to her the more I read her.
So one of the things I've run across recently was a reference to you as the reigning master of rural noir.
Yeah, that's a phrase that's been bandied about lately. And also sometimes they'll say country noir.
Yeah.
And
so what do you think that means?
Yeah, I guess it means, it usually refers to a kind of realist fiction, like I write, but it's fiction that's looking at the dark side of things. And, you know, we're used to this more urban style noir in which we see dark spaces that are lit by streetlights, and we see desperate characters moving through rainy streets. And I guess there is a countryside version of that, which means that we're looking in dark hay barns instead, and we're following characters through the through the desperate struggles that take place in the countryside.
I think you really do that in American Salvage, because you're focusing on Michigan as the bottom drops out of the economy and people are, everyone is sort of struggling.
Yeah, yeah, and especially that American Salvage really was focused on how people who were kind of at the edge of getting by anyway are making that transition to the new economy.
Whatever that is.
And yeah, and it turns out that not everybody's going to make it.
So in American Salvage, you focus on some young women. The character in your novel, Once Upon a River, is a teenage girl, Margot. And many of the stories in Mothers Tell Your Daughters are about the tensions between teenage girls and their mothers. There's a certain theme that runs through all of these. What draws you to that theme?
Yeah, you know, when most writers, if they're like me, are putting together a collection, we don't necessarily set out to write a certain collection. What we do is we write a lot of stories, and then we look through those stories and see what the themes are that have been capturing our imagination, and then we figure out what more work we have to do. And so that was the case with this, is that I saw a lot of mother-daughter interactions, and in looking at my stories, what I realized is that a lot of the voices were people that we hadn't heard from lately, characters that we had of the kind. You know, I talk about my characters like they're real people, but so I'll go ahead and keep doing that.
Well, they are.
But, I know they sure seem
it
real
happens.
To me. And these are women who have not been heard from much. These are women living kind of on the edge, and women who have sometimes suffered a kind of different kinds or different levels of violation, often sexual violation, that has not been acknowledged because it's difficult to describe what they've been going through. And so I wanted to bring some of these voices out and try to explore situations in which women suffer a kind of violation. But I don't want to write about the women as victims. I want to write about the women as adventurers in this life moving through various difficulties.
Well, I think you capture that in Once Upon a River, where Margot is a victim, but she's not a victim. She's like Huck Finn.
Yes, that's what I always hope people get out of it, that, yeah,
she's a survivor.
She's a survivor, like Huck Finn, who is also really technically a victim. I mean, he has terrible parents. He's not treated well from the get-go. And then, of course, he commits his own violations against the people who try to care for him. But with Huck Finn, we're always interested in what's that clever Huck going to do next? And I hope that my characters, even after their difficulties, I hope people are looking not just to say, oh, you know, poor girl, but to say, she's been through this. Now, what's she going to do next? How is she going to cope with this? And what's going to be her next move?
Yeah, I think at the end of the novel, the reader's left with that feeling that she is going to be all right.
Yeah, I hope so. Even though, you know, technically she's just in a real tough spot, a single
Absolutely.
Mom without much education. But I hope that there's that feeling that she's resourceful enough that she's going to figure things out. And I do like to write about people who are resourceful, people who have a lot of skills and resources that maybe take a while to evolve, or resources and skills that don't develop from the get-go, but aren't with them. They don't realize they have them even.
In the newest book, Mothers Tell Your Daughters, there's such a range of different women, different relationships, even locales, and over broad band of time. Where do these stories come from?
Gosh, you're asking the writer the difficult question. we writers have our, like everybody, we writers have our heads all full of stuff. And then when some of that stuff sticks together, you know, and sticks to other stuff, then we think we have a story. And some of these stories are they have their roots in things that I experienced a long time ago. I have led bicycle tours in Eastern Europe, and so there is a story that takes place in Romania.
Children of Transylvania.
Yeah.
It's a great story.
Thank you. And I did, as a youth, travel with the circus, and so there is, I think all my, both my other story collections had a little bit of the circus in them, and this one does too, and this has a girl in the circus who has a bit of a battle before her.
An incredible battle. So in the story, Daughters of the Animal Kingdom, I sort of think about this as a Bonnie Jo Campbell tour de force.
Oh, thank you.
You've got everything. You have this middle-aged college biology professor who suddenly finds herself pregnant. She's struggling with the knowledge that her college professor husband is now involved with a co-ed. Earlier, she had been, as a co-ed, involved with the same professor, right?
Yeah. Yep. What comes around, I guess.
Her life is further complicated with issues with her own daughters and with her mother.
Yeah, and her daughter is pregnant as well at the same time.
And then there are slugs. an area of interest that she has in biology, small, what, sort of unprotected sexual animals moving around with love darts, doing great damage to other slugs.
I know this poor woman who finds herself in this surprising situation and finds herself wanting to spend a lot of time in the chicken coop pondering snails and slugs because of her challenging situation. I really did enjoy having her and as the writer going along with her on this investigation, having her and her look for the answers to her own predicament in the world of different creatures, and I just had a ball writing this.
It's a great story, and the fact that you've covered all of this terrain very quickly and yet make it all turn out is amazing.
Oh, thank you. I know those short stories are miraculous when you can pull them off, aren't they? They when you come to an ending, you're just so happy.
Absolutely. Could you read a little bit from Daughters of the Animal Kingdom?
Oh, I would love to. Thank you. And it's fun. It's fun to have a book of stories coming out because when you have a novel, you're tempted all the time to read from the beginning of the novel. So now it's fun to get an opportunity to read from these parts. So let's try this. Daughters, and I know there's a lot of writers out there, and you'll see that this first section of the story I wrote in a kind of a second person point of view.
Which is different from most of the stories in the book because they're mostly first person.
Yeah, a lot of them are first. A lot of them are first and third.
Yep.
And the second person is kind of fun to play around with. And you'll see that later in the story, I do go into the first person because the second person can get to feel kind of artificial after a while.
Yes.
Daughters of the Animal Kingdom. Say you're the middle-aged child of an increasingly fragile mother who can no longer chop her own firewood, lug bales of hay, or, though she is loath to admit it, even harvest the honeycomb from her hives. For the past 2 months since she decided to take some time away from your entomologist husband, a full professor in the department where you are an underpaid adjunct, and now your mother has found a breast lump and says it's nothing, says she wishes she never had mentioned it. She seemed unmoved when you initially howled at her in exasperation and pantomimed clawing your head with your fingernails, but she is scheduled for surgery this week. Also, let's say the youngest of your own four daughters has become pregnant, and every phone call ends with her hanging up on you because you don't understand what she's going through, what she's trying to achieve holistically by becoming a vegan so as not to poison her baby physically or psychically. No meat or milk, no eggs, no honey, though you made sure she spent summers on her grandmother's farm where she learned to process raw honey using the crush and strain method, as well as to make butter out of the fresh cream from a sweet-natured milk cow named Bambi. And say, meanwhile, in your mother's hen house, your respite from the world of humans, you carry a book in there sometimes. There's this screwy little silky with white feathers on her five-toed feet and more feathers sticking up showgirl style on her head, and she's just decided to hunker down in a nest box and peck anybody who touches her. She stays on that nest all night without food. She pulls out her feathers and warms the eggs against her bare flesh. In the same hen house, there is also one barred rock rooster, lording it over the dozen hens, squiring them to and fro. Sometimes you toss a handful of straw at him, tell him if he doesn't behave, his sky will fall. In truth, that black and white rooster reminds you of your husband, who has young women gathered around him after every class and during office hours. He was your own professor when you were a young single mom, but he has remained a charming, slender man while you have grown fat and grumpy like your mother. He suggested you skip dessert, and this year gave you a gym membership for your birthday. You used to think it merely absurd, the effect he has on college women, until you spotted his Audi outside a cafe in Texas Corners, miles from campus. You were headed for the cheese lady shop to satisfy a craving for Maytag Blue, something you haven't wanted for years. You were surprised to find him there, and he was every bit as surprised to see you, as was the girl beside him in the booth. When you try to convince your youngest daughter to supplement her diet with some eggs for the easily digested protein she needs at this time, free-range, organic, anti-cruelty eggs, you suggest. She informs you that the whole poultry enterprise is immoral for what it does to the males. You are not feeling terribly sympathetic toward the male of any species just now, but you know it would be unconscionable to share with Rosie the particulars of her father's adventure. Your daughter knows you've gone off to stay with your mother, and you've suggested it's a sort of spiritual retreat on the farm, a response to the nest emptying, a desire to get your hands dirty. And you would not especially share your most shocking personal revelation that a stout woman in her early 40s with arthritic joints and age spots can get pregnant. You reflect that in the animal kingdom, females usually reproduce until they sputter out and die. The broody silky guards her clutch against the other hens, knowing some of them steal eggs, tuck them under their wings, the way running backs stash footballs, and start sitting on the stolen property themselves. All broody hens have their hackles up, but some lose their bird brains before the 3 weeks are over and break their eggs in a fit of madness. An especially crazy one might attack the other thieving hen bitches, or even the rooster, disturbing the peace of the hen house, a kind of peace for which you imagine many women would give their egg money or even ransom a child conceived late in life.
Bonnie Jo Campbell reading from Mothers Tell Your Daughters. Thank you, Bonnie Jo.
Oh, thank you.
So your life as a writer, sometimes people think that writers stay in dark rooms and spend all their time looking at screens and making words happen, but you have a husband, a mother who's getting up in years, an extended family, two donkeys.
Some chickens. way too many friends that I like to drink wine with. It's hard to find time to write.
And it's hard to write unless you are out gathering some information about real people and real lives.
Yeah, I've known even as a kid that it was really important to have a really rich life and to have adventures to write about.
Yeah. Your website is very impressive. It tells us all the usual information of where you're going to be. That's probably the most important for our listeners, but it tells us about your books. And then it has a section on information for writers, people who are trying to be writers. I always find this very informative and a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's really, I know so many of us writers, when we start out, we're just struggling to find information in the right form. And I I make it one of my goals to try to demystify writing, to try to talk about how it really is for all of us to do. It's really something we can all do in our own way. And if we can just gather up our personal resources, and then meaning our skills and our desires, but then also see, have a little help on the path toward getting published or toward sharing our work in some way.
And the website is?
www.bonniejocampbell.com.
And your next project is?
Oh, my next project. The one that looks like a big mess on my computer right now. I'm working on a novel about a girl who really loves mathematics.
Oh, surprise, surprise.
So I'm hoping that I can lure my readers into enjoying a little bit of math in addition to the literary parts of the novel.
Bonnie Jo Campbell, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, and you're very welcome.
A group of women and an annual trip to one of Michigan's most remote regions. Marty Jo Link is here to talk about her best-selling new memoir, Drummond Girls, A Story of True Friendship Beyond Time and Chance. Welcome, Marty.
Hi, Aaron. Thank you for having me.
You've had a long, successful writing career, but the last 7 years, you've moved from journalism to 5 books, 3 crime books, 2 memoirs. Incredible productivity. Would you share with our listeners how this all evolved, successfully publishing true crime and then writing 2 best-selling memoirs?
Well, I've heard said about a number of writers that we have that one book in us that has been germinating maybe for decades. And when Evil Came to Goodheart, my first book, that was that book for me. I had thought about that case for years. I had a manila file folder full of newspaper clippings on that case. So when I sat down to write that book, most of it was already, I suppose, written in my subconscious. I just needed to do the research. And I realized that I like telling those kinds of stories. I like the investigation. I like the research. And I liked being able to try to bring a logical chronology to something completely illogical, like crime that's impossible to understand. And so readers responded to that. I was able to do 2 more crime books, Isidore's Secret and Wicked Takes the Witness Stand. But at the same time, I was kind of writing these personal essays about being a single parent, about raising 3 sons, and those essays turned into Bootstrapper. And with the success of Bootstrapper, I was able to write a memoir about my girlfriends.
And Bootstrapper covers 1 year as a single mother.
It did, yeah. 2005 was the year.
And so then how did we get to Drummond Girls?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because I think today if I would approach my publisher or my agent and say, hey, guess what? I want to write a book about my 7 BFFs and our trips to this crazy island in the UP. I can just imagine their response would be, really? Who's going to want to read that?
Go for it, but don't call right. me when it's done.
Yeah, best of luck with that one. I think, but because I've learned how to tell a story through these 4 other books that I saw the potential in our story. And of course, my friends were the ones who came to me and said, hey, we read Bootstrapper. We didn't know you could write like that. But now that we do, when are you going to tell our story?
Drummond Girls opens in 1993. And in the early chapters, you provide some background for each member of the group. Over the next 22 years, you and almost 300 pages, you cover all of the changes that take place. Some things are constant, some things are in flux.
Right. Yeah, I think between the 8 of us, just about anything that an American woman can experience in her lifetime has been dropped in one of our laps and maybe more, from having children, raising children and watching them grow up, to having good relationships with your parents and then losing them, watching each other grow older, having careers take off, having careers take a nosedive, being downsized, starting new businesses, and health concerns. We've pretty much dealt with all of that. And so at the beginning, I wanted to introduce all of these terrific women, and I wanted readers to, if not love them the way that I do, then at least get to know them intimately.
So you had to conceive each character, and did you do a character map or something to make sure you got those specific characteristics tied to each person?
I did a little bit of that character sketching, and for each woman, I tried to think of either the physical characteristics or a mannerism or a hobby or a way of speaking or something that was just unique to them that I could carry throughout the story that would remain constant, that would be one of those kind of signifiers that, okay, we're talking about Mary Lynn now with the high-pitched voice, or we're talking about Andrea now with a terrific sense of humor.
And you signal to your reader each time which character you're talking about.
Right, right.
Did you do a complete outline of the book, or did you just write it as it came to your mind, this in chronological order?
I think the challenge of writing a book like The Drummond Girls that takes place over a large expanse of time is that year after year we go to the island, and it's even though we do the same things, we enjoy it. We like doing the same things. But a reader would just be completely bored if every chapter was, and then we did this again.
Yeah.
And so I looked at our trip log that we kept, and I looked at some photographs. And so I tried to identify, for the years that I wrote about, something that was new or that had changed so that the book wasn't repetitive.
It's interesting because in so many chapters at the beginning, there's a photograph of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. You can see those changes just by...
You can. Yeah, time passes. There's no denying that. Time passes.
You're looking back over two decades. As a memoirist, were you working from journals and diaries, or are you just going from memory?
Much of it was memory. I tried to write the initial draft almost exclusively from memory. But then when I went back to revise, I would open our photo albums. All of the girls gave me their photos, so I got to go through those. And I had big boxes of photographs. I remember one night we met at Linda's house, and we all put our pictures out on her table, and we just kind of touched them like they were these talismans of the past, you know. But when we started going, Linda was very specific about our expenses, and so we started keeping a trip log. And at the beginning, it was just, this is how much gas cost in 1995, or this is how much the ferry was, or guess what, they raised the bridge toll a dollar.
How are we going to stand
it? Right. How are we going to afford it now? That's how the trip log started. But then as our trip grew and our friendship grew, we started writing funny things in that some of the women said, or different observations. And so those were really helpful. It sort of gave me a sense of that time period.
And it's interesting, in the book, you go through the various budgets and how they change. So you see both inflation and the relative wealth of the members of the group.
Right, yeah.
Or lack thereof.
True. I know that Library Journal had a review that said, blue-collar women travel, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that was news, but apparently that's news. But the reason that we started going to Drummond is because that's what we could afford.
Yeah.
It's only 3 hours away. We could get there by car. It was in a waitress's budget. And then now, today, some of us could probably afford to go somewhere else, but we don't want to. We're so connected to that island now that I almost think of it as the ninth Drummond girl.
Yeah.
And so, but certainly in the early years, a budget was extremely important. We wouldn't have been able to go unless we really saved our pennies. A lot of those trips were done on change dishes.
Mm-hmm. And you were staying in old trailers, in fishing camps.
We were at the beginning. Yeah, we were, and we didn't mind it in the least. Today we stay in this beautiful log home, so I'm not sure we want to go back to those old accommodations, but we didn't mind it in the beginning.
Most of us tend to socialize with others who are pretty much like us in age and background. With the Grumman girls, there was a certain commonality, but there was also a diversity in life experience and background. It adds richness to your text. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, I think you're right, Aaron. I think we do tend to just gravitate towards people like us, and yet I was lucky enough to have been hired on as a waitress at this restaurant, PGO's Food and Spirits, which is still around today.
Which was sort of a curiosity. You wandered in there one evening needing to be away from
a crying
kids.
Baby. Yeah.
A crying baby. And yes.
Yeah. And there was a sign up that said waitress wanted. And so they just assumed I was a new face in a place that's full of regulars, and they just assumed I was there for a job. One, Andrea poured me a beer, Jill said hello, and Linda handed me a job application, all just like that. And so I thought, well, why not? Why not? We could use the extra money. And so I filled out the application, and they hired me, and I went to work, and it turned out to be not just a great job when I needed an income, but an entry into an amazing group of women, and not all of them like me. Some not college educated, some not from Michigan, some, I mean, we were different ages, and then we got to be friends with some of the regulars, and again, very different from me. But I think you're right. If you have eight people and you fill this particular role, to round out that group, you need people who have other skills and other experiences and other opinions and viewpoints. And that's what's made our group interesting.
When you actually got the memoir sort of finished, did you have people look through it, the girls? And were there different memories?
Of course, they train you in journalism school to never, ever, ever let anyone see your work before you publish it, which is probably a good thing when you're covering crime and controversial political topics. But these were my best friends, and their friendship was more important to me than any book. And so my agreement with them and the way that I laid it out to them was, I'm going to write a first draft, and you're going to see it even before my editor sees it. And they were happy with that, but they didn't require it. That was more coming from me than from them. And we get together still once a month at Linda's house. We call it Girls Night. And so one day at Girls, I knew it was going to be Girls Night that night, and I snuck over early with a bag of manuscripts. It had all been printed off. There were 7 copies with spiral bindings in the cover, because mm-hmm. the cover had already been decided. And I left him at Linda's house, went over for girls' night. We had a couple of drinks, and we talked and laughed, and it was time for me to go home. And I stood up, and I said, well, I have something for all of you before I leave. And I passed out the manuscripts, and I said, now here's what you do. You get out a red pen, and you find a quiet couple hours, and you try and read it all or as much as you can at one sitting. Mark it up. Tell me what you don't like, what you like, what I got right, what I got wrong. And I'm okay with any of that. Mm-hmm. And I said, and I'll see you know, let me know in a couple weeks. And I'm getting ready to leave. And Susan, whose nickname is Gamer, said, oh, no. That's not how it's going to happen. You sit right down, Missy. And she said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to pass them out right now. And one at a time, we're going to open the manuscript. We're going to read the first sentence out loud that we see. And then we're going to close it and go on to the next girl. Can you imagine having your work reviewed like that? So I did that. I sat down, and we must have laughed for 2 hours. To hear my words in their voice was such a gift. I just felt so blessed that night.
So were your memories the same, or some diversity?
There was some diversity, but they were more intrigued by how I had seen a particular event or how I had understand their personalities. And the things that they took issue with were things like, you know, Marty, that wasn't a Tahoe, it was a Blazer.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a Chevy Tahoe, it was a Blazer. Or, you said that I didn't know what my grandpa grew in his garden, but he grew tomatoes and grapes. Mm-hmm. I knew exactly what he grew. So it was just very specific things like that, but not the emotional stuff. They were okay with all of that.
So can I get you to read something from the Drummond Girls?
Sure. This is the epilogue. It is sometime in the not too far away future, October, and we are racing the dark. In the twilight, an otherworldly glow seems to come from inside the sugar maples, the ones decorating the north shore of Lake Huron. Driving away from home, I felt nothing but anticipation. My sons are grown now and on to their own lives. My husband is happy for the time at home alone. He can fix the downriggers on his fishing boat and tinker with the oil pan on the snow plow, too, without me hovering nearby offering advice. I have a lot of feelings inside of me for him, and not one of them is mechanical. Have fun, my Marty, is what he exhales into my neck when he hugs me goodbye. I feel every muscle in his arms. It's unseasonably cold, and even through his thick canvas jacket, I feel them. Whatever year this is, we've just crossed the mighty Mac. The bridge authority's driver's report was all clear, with visibility estimated at 100 miles plus. We are safely over. There are no other cars on the road, no other headlights, no taillights, no lights at all save the nav screen and its blinking green arrow pointing forever forward. I'm driving, Bev sitting in the passenger seat, Jill and Andrea are in the back messing with a playlist, when, from up ahead, Linda uses Susan's cell phone to call us and impart this detail. As a meteorological concept, visibility is not an exact science. It is simply an estimate of how far 1,000 candles can be seen when illuminated against an unlit background. How cool is that, she wants to know. We are not 1,000 candles. We are only 8. Our background is just up ahead, and we won't even need igniting. Just like those scarlet and gold maple leaves, we are lit from within. We hurtle toward Drummond, burning inside with love, adventure, shared memories, and life. Linda has ideas. Tomorrow we can take a guided tour out to the fossil ledges, or maybe even Marblehead, the remote and scenic cliffs on the island's northern shore. There's a man with a new touring business who will do the driving for us. $60 a person, but probably worth it. Or we could just hike there. 6 miles through some pretty wild and dense woods, but also probably worth it. Bev likes the second idea. She's nearly 70 now. Still has her same hiking boots from 1995, but even so, with her buoyant stride, she'll be the first of us to the trailhead. Bears? Nah, she's not worried about bears. She's not worried about anything. A grin takes over her face. Remember that year we danced at the Northwood, she asked? Remember how great that band was? I don't remember, and I glance out her window at the water, watch it pass by at highway speed, and then refocus on the road ahead. We are racing the dark. Bev didn't volunteer or learn to play the piano after she retired, but she did travel. Alaska, New Zealand, Australia, Africa, and next, Spain. Sometimes I get to be the one who picks her up from the airport. I get to look into her eyes and see the lively person inside, still so engaged with the world. Often when I'm with her and she is walking me around her garden, telling me about each plant, where she bought it, how much it costs, the environment it prefers, whether or not the deer will eat it, I find the face of the girl I imagined she once was. Alert. Curious, happy. I wonder if she ever looks at my face, notices a new smile line, a new forehead wrinkle, and sees the girl I'll always be. Just as we clear Detour Hill, the last bit of a red sun sinks into the tamaracks. We'll be first in line for the ferry this year because Drummond is waiting and we are racing the dark. Susan calls again. Andrea puts her on speaker. Remember your fairy manners, she says. And then I hear Pam and Linda hooting in the background. Jill throws her head back and laughs out loud. Those girls are fired up, she says. About this time, Bev will ask how many years it's been. Then we'll drive onto the ferry. The island will come into view, and we'll all know the answer. It's been always. It will always be always. It is the first weekend in October. And we are racing the dark.
Marty Jo Link reading from The Drummond Girls. Now a writerly question. How long did The Drummond Girls take? I know some of your projects have taken years and years.
They have. Drummond Girls went a little quicker. It was about a year and a half to research and write and revise.
Now, Marty, you have a lot of loyal readers of your crime work in this area and across the country now. Wicked Takes the Stand, A True Murder and a Twisted Deceit in Northern Michigan is your newest one. Could you give our listeners a few hints of what this one's about?
Sure. That book, the inception of that book was two attorneys approached me and they had read the other true crime books that I had written.
And that was a long time ago.
That was quite a while ago. And they said, we worked on a case of some notoriety in Northern Michigan. And we think that it would make a good book. My initial reaction was to say no, because of the amount of time it takes to research one of these books, usually whatever it is that creates that spark to write and research one comes from inside the writer, not from some exterior force. But these attorneys were of some renown. One of them had been Grand Traverse County's prosecutor. So I sat down with them, learned more about the case, became fascinated by five different trials, five defendants, and one extremely creative, unusual, manipulative witness. A dream for a writer to write about a character like that. And so I said yes. I really had no idea what I was getting into when I said that. And it took me 6 years to research and write that book. And Aaron, it is the first book of mine that has ever made the New York Times bestseller list.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's something. It's been on the crime list since January. So apparently people don't mind 425-page crime books with very small redemption at the end.
Well, there are a group of people who love true crime, and you have really created a place for yourself in that genre.
Well, I remain fascinated by the law and by the psychology behind crime, and I can't say that was my last one. Who knows? I might tackle something
else. Well, that's my next question. What's next?
Well, like a number of people my age, I have really been bit by the genealogy bug, and I find myself almost obsessed by it, and I know when I have that obsessive feeling that usually that obsession turns into a book. I'm not sure how or what structure or what it will be about, but somehow I think the genealogy research I'm doing now will end up on some pages.
Well, we look forward to that. If listeners want to find out more information about you, you have a Facebook page?
I do, right? MartyLink.com or MartyLink at Facebook. And then I have a website too.
And your website has lots of information about you and your books, and perhaps most importantly for listeners who want to find you, your calendar.
Right. That's on my website, and that's MartyJoeLink.com.
So this has been really a pleasure. The book again is Drummond Girls, A Story of True Friendship Beyond Time and Chance. And Marty Link, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Aaron. It's been great.
Fleeta Brown is here. Happy fall, Fleeta.
Oh, thanks, Aaron. I just am so happy to be here again this fall. I'd like to tell you about a new book by Ed Ochester. It's called Sugar Run Road. Ed Ochester is a longtime editor of Pitt Poetry Series, and he also teaches at Bennington MFA Writing Seminars. He's published 7 books of poems, and he's won a string of awards. His poetry is always spoken by a plain voice that just wants to say something. It doesn't exactly preach, but it reminds us how much there is at stake, even in the speaking. Let me give you this little example. The poem is called Sunflowers. The ornamental sunflowers aren't turning to face the sun as they're supposed to, but Brit's just seen, first time ever, a yellow-throated warbler. Yesterday, when Judith and I were talking about how to reduce our workloads, I saw a headline in the Times, 60 more Iraqis killed by bomb blasts. What's that now? 150,000 civilians? More than Hussein would have, could have? Strange contrast. You don't know where you will be, but you'd better see where you are. There's almost no punctuation in this poem. And fact, in the whole book. The book title and the titles of the poems aren't capitalized. You're reading, in a way, the inside of a person's mind before it gets all neatened up. Do we know who Brit is, who Judith is? Probably not, unless we read all the poems or unless we know Ed. You're overhearing the mind almost as it moves. First the sunflowers, the seeing, and then what we must see, what we better see now, better see where we are. Here's another poem that mentions people the average person wouldn't know. I thought about that before I picked it, but it really doesn't matter. I think you get the poem. It's called Poetry, and that's what it's about. He begins with a line from Marianne Moore's poem, also called Poetry. I, too, dislike it. The mystified truisms, the dusty puzzle prunes, the theatrical exaggerations, and this is a quote, the brutal crescendo of woodworms. Yet I think of O'Hara's delight in the endless pleasures of quotidian life, and Duhamel throwing a dozen balls in the air and juggling them all. Frank said only a few poems are as good as the movies, but that was a long time ago, before a lot of bad movies, before background music, before there was almost no silence and the private life is an insult to others. Poetry is the most private art. Lee Young remembering his father combing his mother's hair, Stern and Gilbert with their mouths open walking down a street in Paris, Judith writing the mysteries of level green and her father's radioactive chambers, Catullus registering his private ecstasies and fears while the machine of the state ground on, Cannell saying, "Go so deep into yourself, you speak for everyone." You can feel this very public kind of speech going deep into the speaker, and it does speak for all of us, it seems like. So here's one that's different. It's called September Rain. Old house of children's laughter and tears, then and now the spruces bend under the rain. The red maple we planted last spring has survived the summer's drought. The garden is ready for snow. I've spent much of my life walking a few acres between two unnamed hills. I shouldn't brag, I know. So many people don't know where they live. So the poem in the book that follows that is called Fall, which seems appropriate. Crows, 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 crows. Then the slow flap away over the hill, and the dead oak is naked. I wanted to read those two poems together because they do what Ochester means in the first poem I read, You Better See Where You Are. The poems are also rooted personally. You think, whoa, there's not much artifice here. It's just speaking. Is that lazy or what? Then you see that over and over, he's anchoring himself and you in exactly what is, and when seen well, it's poetry. Here's another perfect illustration. A lot of the dialogue in this poem is in all caps, so I'll try to be loud so you can tell the difference. The poem is called At a Country Diner. Elderly couple walk in, sit down. Guy stands up to see the menu board better. Wife squints at it from table. Onion rings, he says. They got onion rings with the BLT on a special. What, she says, onion rings. I like them with ketchup, she says. I think I'll get that. They're two booths away, but her perfume already is very thick around me. They cut off his Social Security for 18 months. And then, a 38 special with a beautiful walnut tiger strike stock. While she nods again. The waitress comes over and says, Know what you want? The wife says, I forgot. And then, oh, I remember the BLT special. The waitress tries to be helpful. That comes with onion rings. Honey, the wife says, smiling sweetly, I'm not deaf, you know. There it is again. See where you are. If you do, it's absolutely wondrous all by itself. Ochester is bluntly political, as you heard in the Sunflowers poem. Here's another called Dialectic. The epigraph is from David Lehman. In college, the first theme you had to write was on the American dream. It'd be great to live in a free enterprise society instead of a monopoly capitalism society. Didn't Teddy Roosevelt bust up the trusts? Now the rich guys give the senators copies of laws they want passed. When I lived in Madison, a city named after a president most historians think was an atheist, but Republicans will tell you was the father of a Christian republic, we rented an apartment for $70 a month from an elderly farmer who had a photo of Teddy R. tacked to his kitchen wall. I thought then the farmer was a reactionary. Now he'd be a flaming radical. Today, I'm watering marigolds in July with the temperature in the 90s, and a wren is singing his heart out. Talk about free enterprise. He's got three or four nests inside half an acre. Something to really crow about, though. Unlike roosters and various demagogues, wrens, of course, don't crow. I have to read you one more. This is called For Brit, and the epigraph tells it's in honor of Beethoven's birthday. It looks a little like a sonnet, but it only has 13 lines instead of 14, which is just like Ochester. Beethoven is such a great composer, but his personality is questionable, which shows once again that one is what one does. Music, poems, or even money have claims, but also such unremarked acts as feeding sparrows in winter, which God doesn't do too well, though we're told he notes the fall of every one. So that as I park the car, your sparrows in the snow-covered forsythia greet the weak sun with a matrix of cheeping, dozens of them, not from gratitude, but perhaps from overflowing joy. That poem manages to praise Brit for feeding the sparrows while at the same time releasing everyone from causes and motives. Sparrows cheep because of joy, period. The poet is Ed Ochester. The book is Sugar Run Road from Autumn House Press.
Thank you, Flita. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Bonnie Jo Campbell, Marty Jo Link, and Flita Brown. Also, kudos to Brock Moorman and Peter Payette for their skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.